Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Susie Kim, and I'm from Dietl International. And this portion of this session, we'll be talking more about the logistics and the enforcement aspect, especially under the guidelines of directors, new directors 210. I'm sure most of us in this room will agree that besides preserving our cultural heritage, exhibiting artworks is one of the most important things our institutions can do. Exhibitions reflect our concerns and our ideas. It challenges our philosophies and preconceptions. But how do we exhibit and ship objects that contain protected materials derived from animals protected under the U.S. Endangered Species Act? The purpose of the ESA is to protect and recover imperiled species and its ecosystem upon which they depend, which includes plants and certain wood species. This presentation will walk you through the steps of exporting and importing objects with restricted materials in and out of the country in compliance with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, especially under the new guidelines of Directors 210. Please note that the public comments for the director's order is still under review and the final rule has yet to be released. What our panel hopes to emphasize, however, is that establishing a collaborative relationship with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the borrower, the lender, the shipper, is vital in ensuring the safe and expedient shipping and return of your loans. However, we must not forget the important role conservation plays as a whole. Besides the fact that all living species have an inherent right to exist, saving wildlife is the responsibility of all of us. And we, as a dominant species, must take care of the environment. Protecting and preserving wildlife and educating future generations of the value of all living things, creatures, is responsibility that must be shared, but often left for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. As part of the U.S. Department of Interior, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife serves as one of the most important federal agencies in efforts to protect endangered species and preserve habitats. The agency is a respected steward of the environment whose service effort is to manage ecosystems and save endangered species. The Office of Law Enforcement regulates wildlife trade, helps Americans understand and obey wildlife protection laws, and works in partnership with international and state and tribal counterparts to conserve wildlife resources while providing information to importers and exporters on federal laws and regulations. But what I find, what really sets them apart from other federal agencies, is the fact that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife officers are not only superbly educated in both domestic and international wildlife laws, they are passionately dedicated to their field of work and study. Conservation is not just a vocation for them. It is genuinely their life mission to conserve and recover our global habitat for future generations. They are incredibly approachable to shippers and, for the most part, very patient. Their willingness to understand and collaborate with our industry to educate the public on the importance of conservation should be admired and respected. So the question remains, what is happening in the legal restructuring of ivory and how is it affecting our artwork, our art world? I'm sorry. Go back. Please allow me to introduce to you our expert panelists and in the order in which they will speak. Our first speaker will be Emily Foss, Associate Registrar for Outgoing Loans for the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. As Associate Registrar, she coordinates loans, packing, shipping for traveling exhibitions. Secondly, I will speak from a freight forwarder's point of view as Senior Project Manager at Dietl International in New York to discuss fish and wildlife applications, fish and wildlife clearances, and navigating the fish and wildlife website. Lastly, we have Inspector Naima Aziz, Supervisory Inspector of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office of Law Enforcement in JFK, to discuss the enforcement of the administrative actions to strengthen U.S. trade controls of elephant ivory as well as other ESA listed species and how the new action will affect the art world. And then I will introduce Emily.
So many people up here today. Good afternoon, everyone. That's loud. Okay. So my name is Emily Foss. I work for the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I'm an associate registrar there, and I work on outgoing loans. I do occasionally, about once a year, handle traveling exhibitions, but I primarily work on loans of artworks from our collections, mostly to all of you, and a few people who aren't here today. So I'd like to thank, firstly, the Arts Committee for holding this amazing conference. I've learned so much. I'm sure you all have as well. And I'd also like to thank Fritz Dietl, Susie Kim, and Deirdre O'Connell for having me on this panel today. So we're primarily broken up between outgoing loans, as I said, artworks from the collection, and then special exhibitions, so artworks coming in. So I'm going to talk about my side of the office first, so outgoing loans. All the artworks you'll see in my presentation are Met works. So today, in our partnering to conserve, we are going to talk about obtaining a CITES license, really the nuts and bolts of what goes into it, for those that haven't submitted one before, application before, or for those that have one coming up or are concerned about how new legislation is affecting the application process. So there will be an emphasis on ivory, but as many of my panelists have spoken about before, that is by no means the only artwork that is restricted by Fish and Wildlife, and I'll get into that a little as well, although not nearly as in-depth as Inspector Aziz. So current legislation, I know, has many institutions hesitant to lend ivory. I have worked on several loans outgoing to institutions where people have come to me saying, I have a lender who's pulled out, and we're trying to refill in a checklist. So today we're going to try to allay some of those fears. And as far as the fears go, they are legitimate, and no loan is made without risk. Our artworks are safest when they are at home and not on the road, but that's not why we're here. We are here to share our collections with everybody. So I'd like to walk you through our process. We have been successful both with incoming and outgoing ivory loans, and I'll show it to you from the registrar's side of things. Okay. So when we lend artwork abroad, outgoing loans at the Metropolitan are handled by Caitlin Corrigan, Nesta Alexander, and Hope Cullinan, and myself. Last year, the Met loaned over 1,200 artworks. The number of CITES works change year to year, from traveling exhibitions that we send on the road that contain many, many pieces to when you yourselves require artworks from us. This year, we only had 4 CITES loans. Each one of them added a significant amount of work to an already very busy schedule. So I don't know if you can read this, but this is primarily our process for handling outgoing loans. For an international loan, we require 10 months notice. So that's when you send our director a copy of your request letter. And that's when the balls really start getting rolling here at the museum. So a lot of times, curators get in touch with each other before those letters go out. We ask that our curators notify us as soon as possible when there's work with ivory or a different restricted species comes into the discussion. So the various types of information required by Fish and Wildlife, which I will get into my next panel, it's really contributed to our documentation by a lot of different departments at the Met. I'm incredibly lucky that I am supported by so many knowledgeable colleagues that are all in-house. Our data is provided by offices of the registrar, conservation, and curatorial. And we've spoken already today about identifying genus, species, and family of the work. We have in-house conservation and specialists that are willing to make those suggestions and decisions for us, but I know that that is rare and that many have to hire out of house, and that is, of course, an expense that goes into the loan. So if we're really talking about specifics about how artwork leaves the building, budgets are a reality for all of us. And as is budgeting for time, having to bring in an out-of-house specialist will add to the amount of time needed for your application. And as I have heard in virtually every panel on every subject so far today, budgeting for time, planning ahead, is one of the biggest things we do, really. So we take all the documentation that we gather, and we submit it to our customs brokers, so that would be John or Susie, and they take it to Fish and Wildlife. So this is primarily what we put together for our Fish and Wildlife packet that we give to our customs broker. A lot of this is very self-explanatory. The 100 years, as Michael McCullough has already stated, that gives the antiques exemption, but is by no means the only date you need to worry about. Art historical, this is really where curatorial comes into play. What tells us the most about this piece, where it comes from in the timeline of art history, where it comes from in the world, and that also plays into comparisons from what type of animal was available to the artist at the time. And then comparison, can you compare your artwork that you're sending out with something else that you have in the collection that has already been confirmed? If you can, I would also include that in the letter. The stronger argument you can make, the best. And then provenance. This is one of the most important things you can have in your letter. Acquisitions information. If it was possibly a recent acquisition, you'll have an existing CITES certificate. Do make sure that that is also part of your packet. So the amount of information that you need for this packet is a significant investment of time and energy for your staff. When you have gathered your data, make sure you are confident in what you are presenting. Your packet is only as strong as the information that you are providing. If Fish and Wildlife has questions, they will ask. So be prepared. Ivory on the Road. This is one of my favorite pieces in the collection. He's a small ivory piece. It fits into about the palm of your hand, and he caused an awful lot of trouble for something so small. In addition to the CITES license that was required to send him to Qatar in 2011, I also needed an OFAC license. And at this point, I wanted to bring up, as my other panelists have and will talk about, that there are other restrictions other than just ivory and the migratory bird, marine mammal, and OFAC. So who has ever gotten an OFAC license before? Okay, very interesting. So who knows what an OFAC license is? Same number, okay. So in addition to your fish and wildlife restrictions, OFAC, if the country of origin of your piece is one that there might be a trade embargo on, that might require an OFAC license. This is another question that you can bring up to your customs broker, as I often do. So really you're needing to look into the location of the art at the time. Some of the countries on the map today didn't exist when this guy was made, so it's important to really do your research and talk with your curatorial department, because this is an issue. We haven't mentioned this yet, but there's also the Lacey Act. So that recently, in the last 20 years or so, has come to include CITES-restricted woods and plants. So that was news for me. So that means ivory and rosewood. These are things that are found a lot in museum collections, especially musical instruments. So it's something to keep in mind. That information is also available on the Fish and Wildlife website in the appendices. All right, just for show and tell, this is an example of a CITES certificate that I have. I apologize that it's an old one. Inspector Aziz has a much newer, the newer exciting version of this. As you can see, it took about 2 months for me to get my certificate, but that was a few years ago. There are more restrictions in place now. People are taking a much closer look specifically at ivory, so plan even more time. Again, especially if you need to go out of house for staff, if you need to do more research, if you are a smaller staff and you are working on multiple projects at one time. So this is an older CITES license. As you know, you would have to apply for an export license, and then to bring it back into the country, you would need to do a reimportation license. Now Fish and Wildlife offers this amazing document. It's the Traveling Exhibition CITES license, and it really acts as a passport, allowing the artwork to go out and come in under the same document. This saves a tremendous amount of time. There's no reimportation to worry about, and I think it really represents Fish and Wildlife responding to our concerns, our questions, and creating this document to really help both sides of the story, getting our artwork in and out of the country safely. So, as I said, nuts and bolts, how we make these things work. So, a big part of the process, once your certificate is in place, when we start getting into the packing of the artwork, we always, at the Met, we always pack our restricted species items separately. No matter how small, I have sent an ivory comb, it's about fit in the palm of my hand, with a much larger piece of furniture. They do not go in the same crate. We always pack those items separately, no matter the size difference. And again, this is another cost issue. This is time issue as well. Reasons why we do this. This simply helps expedite the shipment. If it is, it is entirely possible that the artwork will need to be inspected when it gets to the airport. We hope not, but it's a possibility. This way you don't have to open up your other crate. Other things you can do to help at the airport, make sure your courier or whomever is traveling with your artwork has copies of everything. Never hurts to give them extra paper. Copies of the CITES license, color images, correspondence, application letter, all good to have in hand. Special exhibitions, the other side. So we have many special exhibitions every year. It's so great to be working in such an exciting institution. Our special exhibitions in the Registrar's Office are handled by Aileen Chuk, our Chief Registrar, Meryl Cohen, Nina Maruka, Allison Verone, and Sarah Boyd. The past year in the Registrar's Office, our special exhibitions registrar has brought in 1,500 artworks. So, as I said, we do amazing shows at the Met. We're very lucky to work there. But I will focus on Iceria to Iberia. This was a show we held last year. It was our first show we did that contained ivory that we opened after Director's Order 2010 came out, with the sort of further restrictions being more emphasized. So we have a lot of lenders who were already set to lend, and then Director's Order 210 came out, so we wanted to do more to sort of allay their fears and to really expedite the loans into the country. We came up with a document that we prepare now whenever we have ivory loans coming into the United States. So it's a fact sheet that we prepare to Fish and Wildlife, and we send a binder to them with color images and all sorts of good documentation, sort of a one sheet that you would get out of TMS with the basic object information. I'll have a little bit more on that later. So as you can see, we had 30 ivory loans to this exhibition, and every single one of them was approved. It was a major accomplishment. This took a tremendous amount of work from curatorial, conservation, and it was a huge relief for our registrar, Masterpiece as well, and also for Fish and Wildlife. We could not have done it without being such a big group effort. Of course, the real benefit in this amazing success was the people who came to see the exhibition. They got to see really one-of-a-kind works from truly far-flung places that they might not ever visit. So in the end, when this is done right, the real winners are the people that come see the shows. So, borrowing works that contain CITES materials. We ask that our foreign lenders apply for traveling exhibition CITES licenses. Now, this is a slightly new document, and I understand that not all issuing foreign agents have access to the traveling exhibition CITES license. For those of you who are from abroad and your agency says that they cannot do that, I encourage you to go to your local Fish and Wildlife office, and they will liaise with the foreign office and get that documentation in place for you. Again, this is one of those things that can't be done early enough. Again, allow for plenty of time, work with your local office. And then for the incoming paperwork for what we provide to Fish and Wildlife, this is just a little bit more detail. Detailed object information, provenance, color images, published references, so important to have to be able to give to Fish and Wildlife. And we provide this in a binder for them. The most clear, concise documentation you can give, the more expedient the process is, the faster the work's clear. So, rounding up. Looking ahead, upcoming loans and long-term loans. The Metropolitan Museum of Art maintains over 3,000 long-term loans in this country and around the world. We have about 500 artworks overseas. Some of these loans go back decades, and some of them contain restricted materials and ivory. When these artworks will be recalled one day, we will need to make sure that the documentation that we sent them out on is good enough to bring them back. So if you are reviewing your long-term loans, I would make it a point to look at any restricted materials, see what documentation was in place before it needs to be called back an emergency for an exhibition, something like that. Again, planning ahead. Conservation, and this will come up, it's come up previously, it will come up before. Make sure you have detailed conservation records. Conservators are scientists and artists. We are so lucky to have them working with us. And it's really important that detailed information and records be kept on your works, especially ones that contain ivory and restricted materials. Sometimes conservation work in the best interest of the piece can remove the antique status of the artwork. So the more information you have, the safer the artwork will be. So in the end, why take the risk? What is an acceptable risk? I was just speaking to one of my colleagues about this a few hours ago. Why would we put our artworks in danger? It is all about good stewardship. And as I said earlier, really, I think we'd all be happier if they just stayed home. But as we know, good stewardship is not just about proper care and handling, maintenance of our art. The purpose of almost all of our institutions, if not all, is to share our collections with the world. So when the conditions are right, when the paperwork is complete, when it's able to be lent, we should make that effort because these artworks are really meant to tell a story. So I look forward to hearing from you at the Q&A session. Thank you.
So back again. So as an art shipper, what happens when we're entrusted with the privilege to ship an ESA restricted object which falls within the guidelines of the administration order 210? As some of you might already know, on June 9, 1989, the U.S. Congress passed the African Elephant Conservation Act moratorium, which implemented measures to manage, conserve, and protect African elephants. In response to the significance of illegal trade and decline of African elephant ivory, the United States released their first strategy for combating wildlife trafficking on February 11, 2014. This order superseded all previous policies, including African Elephant Conservation Act moratorium, implemented a complete ban on allowing commercial importation of African ivory into the United States, even for items that qualified as antique under the ESA exemption. After much public criticism, a revised version of the Director's Order 210 was released on May 15, 2014, with less stringent criteria, especially on the importation of African ivory for non-commercial, scientific, educational purposes that qualify as an antique under the ESA. As mentioned previously, the final ruling 210 has yet to be released. So what do we do in the meantime? we formulate a strategy. My strategy tends to follow a similar pattern. Equip yourself with some basic knowledge of the object and the fish and wildlife laws. You want to be able to have a preliminary discussion with your shipper and fish and wildlife officer to make sure and identify that the shipment meets the criteria for export and import under the new director's order. Clarity. Simple is best. Start with the basics. Identify the purpose of your shipment. Is your shipment a commercial versus a non-commercial? Because the criteria are going to be very different. Commercial shipments fall under the following categories. An acquisition, a purchase, perhaps your museum is deaccessioning. While non-commercial are defined as temporary traveling exhibitions, donations, household moves, inheritance, or scientific research. Now that you have properly identified the purpose of your shipment, I'd like to share with you some helpful tips on how to navigate the U.S. Fish and Wildlife website in 2 to 4 steps. So you go to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife website, which is www.fws.gov. Let me see if the pointer works. Okay. Whoops, let's go back. And on the left-hand column, you'll see a lot of different categories. I tend to go to the import and exporting tab, which will lead you to the next page. I love this page. This is my go-to page. It has everything. It has a great Q&A session. This is where I do all of my preliminary research. It has a species search, and the species search will actually tell you if you need a CITES, if it needs a federal permit, what kind of permit you require, and the appendix of the CITES. This page will also automatically link you to the Form 3177 EDECT, which is simply a declaration to U.S. Fish and Wildlife that you intend to ship an object containing a wildlife. It's important to remember that the basic fish and wildlife requirements have not changed. Does your shipper have a valid U.S. Fish and Wildlife license, and who needs it? A license is generally required for all individuals or businesses that engage in importing and exporting wildlife. In simpler terms, if you want to drive a car, you need to have a driver's license. It's the same premise. I recommend that every shipper, including museums, apply for a fish and wildlife license. The license is valid for 1 year, and a copy of the valid license will be requested time and again to apply for a CITES, as well as all federal permits, and finally to clear the shipment with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office of Law Enforcement through your EDEC. The next step in the strategy is to accurately identify the specimen. For instance, it's not enough to identify the species as an elephant. You must specify the object as an African elephant, Africana loxodonta, or Asian elephant, Elephas maximus. Does your loan qualify for an ESA antique exemption? What does that mean, and how do I prove it qualifies for the exemption? Here is a list of the principles. Is it a bona fide antique, meaning is it over 100 years old? Do you have a copy of the bill of sale or proper provenance to prove? If your answer is no, please hire an expert conservator to identify the circuit date and obtain a written statement attesting that the object is a bona fide antique. Is it comprised in whole or in part as an ESA listed species? Basically, does your object contain wildlife? If so, what is the specimen? Is it protected under ESA? Has it been modified or repaired with another ESA-listed species after December 1973? Please note that replacing the base of your antique with a new base does not count as modification or repair. So I start to prepare a 3177E deck. Again, an e-deck is simply a declaration to U.S. Fish and Wildlife that you wish to import and export an object that contains a wildlife. The object must be imported or exported through a U.S.-designated antique port. There are 13 of these locations, as you can see in the map. So what are the big changes under the Director's Order 210? And when is it time to contact your local U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department for collaboration? A good time for me is when you have all your supporting documentation together and you're ready to apply for a CITES document or permit. Make sure you send a CITES application to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office of Management Authority in Fairfax, Virginia, and not your local U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office of Law Enforcement. They're two different offices with two different responsibilities. Please make sure to apply for the correct permit for your transaction. For traveling exhibitions, apply for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife CITES Form 3-200-30. This CITES permit is exclusively for the purpose of temporary travel for museum exhibitions where objects do not change ownership, a true non-commercial activity. This form functions similarly to an ATA carnet and can be used to export and re-import the object at the close of the exhibition. But please make sure to validate the CITES at each port of entry and export. A wildlife officer must sign and stamp the CITES at the port of export and import for the CITES to be validated. It would be a shame to go through all that trouble to apply for a CITES and all that time just to find out when you're shipping that you haven't validated the CITES and it's no longer valid. For shippers, ask your client to provide you with specific supporting documentation to enable you to complete the form with accuracy. Supporting documentation should include a simple mission statement from the museum summarizing the activity they propose to conduct and why their activity meets the CITES issuance criteria under the ESA for educational purposes, a copy of the provenance of the object from a catalog, a photograph, or literature, copies of the cleared 3177 clearance to prove that it was properly imported into the United States, copies of the importing CITES form, CITES permit, and lastly, a performant invoice for the circa date with the circa date and a scientific name of the wildlife. So now you're ready to speak with your local fish and wildlife officer. So get your ducks in a row. Have a dialogue with your local fish and wildlife officer to discuss the proposed shipment. Come up with a collective understanding that the purpose of your non-commercial traveling exhibition does not contribute to the poaching of the illegal trade crisis. As an example, I was asked by the American Museum of Natural History to work on an exhibition entitled Traveling the Silk Roads. This exhibition brought to life one of the greatest trading routes in human history, and it showcased the goods, cultures, and technologies from far reaches of China through the cities and empires of Central and West Asia from 600 AD to 1200 AD. Visitors embarked on an unparalleled journey exploring commerce, communication, and cultural exchange, which often included wildlife. We discovered that these pieces made with endangered animal pelts, ivory, horn, illustrated the world of the Silk Road in a way that replicas would not have been able to match. By getting the U.S. Fish and Wildlife involved early in the process, with the awareness that education through the arts is a vital part of connecting to the public, we attained a common agenda. This would not have been possible or easy without all the parties involved. The museum, the shippers, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife working together as a team. So here are my 5 commandments for a collective mindset. Come up with a common agenda. All participants sharing a common vision and understanding, and have the willingness to approach in solving the struggle through agreed actions. Continuous communication. That's kind of self-explanatory, but ask questions. Voice your concerns. Confirm timing, schedules with all parties. Get a backbone support. Create a team of experts in the field. Let the experts do what they do best. Get all eyes on the problem. Identify the potential struggle as a group and come up with a collective solution. Perhaps your flight is delayed and is now arriving after hours, or even worse, the weekend. What happens to the shipment? Does Fish and Wildlife clear shipments over weekends? Those are great questions to ask before you dispatch your shipment. And lastly, come up with a strategy. Create a specific structure to approach the tangible set of activities that will ensure progress towards your end goal. Lastly, I would like to share with you a real-life experience of a collective mindset and its humbling results. The collective story of how a team shipped Lonesome George from the Galapagos Islands to the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Because regardless of many factors that threaten animals today, the bottom line is once an animal is extinct, it's gone forever. In 2012, the American Museum of Natural History in New York asked me to help them bring in Lonesome George to the museum from the Galapagos Islands. He was the last of his species, the Pinta Island tortoise, and passed away after several breeding attempts which failed. As a shipper, I was instinctively focused on what's the size of the crate. What's the location and final destination? What is the quickest route? Timing. It was against us. Lonesome George was refrigerated, but how quickly can we get him through customs from both port and delivered to the American Museum of Natural History before he starts to decompose? Flights. What are the options? What flight operates within that region? Permits. Are they required? He is extinct. We failed to conserve his species. Do we need a permit? I recognized that the real issue would be the CITES issuance and timely clearance. How do you clear a CITES permit for an extinct species? Is a physical inspection required? I decided to call my local Fish and Wildlife officer and explain my concerns and tell him I was really struggling. I was surprised to discover that he was also unsure of the laws regulating CITES permit and clearances for extinct animals, especially in contemporary times, but understood we had to act quickly to preserve Lonesome George. He immediately contacted his supervisor, created a team of his own, and decided to pre-clear Lonesome George while the flight was still in the air. Upon arrival to JFK, Lonesome George received the VIP treatment. He was pre-cleared by both U.S. Fish and Wildlife and U.S. Customs, first to come off the plane, loaded onto a temperature-controlled exclusive art truck, and delivered directly to the museum. At this time, I would like to share with you a small video clip of Lonesome George and how he changed my collective mindset on collaboration and conservation.
Unfortunately, all of the giant tortoises in the Galapagos are at risk of extinction. We used to consider them as all one or a couple of species, and now that we're more aware that there are a number of species, we need to maintain them as separate species and ensure that we manage them as distinct units into the future. There used to be giant forces across the world, and now there are only two different groups left, one of them in the Galapagos and the other one in Aldabra. I actually think since Lonesome George touched so many lives that it's critical for us to have a specimen that people can relate to, and if he is an iconic representative of human use of resources right now in the world. People can go and see this amazing organism that no longer walks the face of the earth and reflect on what we can do better in the future.
It was incredibly humbling, not to mention stressful, to be entrusted with the safe transport of the last of its species. But I want it to also be the last time we have to transport the remains of any of a last of a species. While we must continue to exhibit pieces in our collection that were made of ivory or horn or other restricted items, we must also assist U.S. Fish and Wildlife law enforcement in their efforts and advocate for the conservation in and outside of our institutions. The best way to ensure both our goals are met is to make sure that all parties are in consistent and productive dialogue. Thank you.